This is Santos Bonacci, and you are listening to Veritas.
The whole definition of the root of the word government, as you said, meant and govern, governing your mind. Was Israel ever there to harass you?
Israel, no, we didn't see Israel. We didn't go through Israel. We went through Egypt to get into Gaza. There was a rocket hit northern Gaza while we were in there. Palestine didn't respond. Gaza didn't respond. There were three fishermen shot off the coast one morning while we were there as well. Palestine didn't respond. Gaza didn't respond. So, I mean, Gaza is under attack from Israel all the time. We were there for 10 days. The people were amazed that there was only one rocket attack and three fishermen shot while we were there. They said, normally we get planes fly over and they'll drop a bomb or two on us every couple of days, every two or three days. They just lob them over there until we respond. And then when we respond, they cry out victim and they carpet bomb us.
Yeah.
You know?
It's almost like a setup.
Well, it is. It's all a complete setup. And really, when you look at it, they push the Palestinian people so hard. They really do. The rules they've got, even in the West Bank and even within Israel, they've got an apartheid system. You've got the law of return, which grants, Jewish, nationality. And that is, different to Israeli citizenship. Israeli citizenship is just citizenship, but nationality is where you get your rights from. So if you're a Jewish national, you have rights in Israel. But if you're just an Israeli citizen, you don't. You've got to be a national to have rights. So, I mean, you can be a Saudi Arabian and come and live in Israel and you'll have rights. Not a problem because you've got nationality. You can be from any other country and come and live in Israel and live in a perfectly balanced society. Everyone's got rights. But if you're a Palestinian, you don't have nationality. Therefore, you don't have any rights. You have Israeli citizens.
You're pariah?
Yeah. So you don't have any rights if you're a Palestinian. And so, and the Israeli people, they have no idea that this is the way the system is. So they just think, these Palestinians, they just complain all the time. Why do they complain all the time? Look what we give them. We've given them all this stuff. They just complain. You know, you'd shoot them too if they lived in your country. You know, get rid of them. You know, they're just whingers. They're just complainers. They don't understand that they live in an apartheid system because they have no nationality. So therefore they have no rights. Therefore, Israel can come onto their land and just bulldoze your house. They come into people's houses. They dig a moat. They dig like an 8-meter moat around your house or around your suburb. And then they come in, they get all the families out midnight, say, look, you've all got to leave now. They just take them out, put them on the other side of the moat and say, that's it. You don't go back now. And you can't get back because there's an 8-meter moat dug around your suburb. And that's it. Your land's gone. You're dispossessed now. Middle of the night, go away. Thanks for coming. That's it. And it doesn't matter. You have no recourse because you're a Palestinian, so you have no rights. And that's it. So I've got this two-tiered legal system in place where you've got to have nationality to have rights. And you don't have Israeli nationality. Even the Supreme Court will not recognize Israeli nationality. They'll only recognize Jewish nationality. They'll recognize Israeli citizenship, but not Israeli nationality. And that's where they do it. That two-tiered legal system. You've got to have nationality to have rights within Israel. Doesn't matter what nation you come from, but you've got to have nationality to have rights. If you're a Palestinian, you have no nationality, so you have no rights. And that's the way they've done it. And that should be starkly apparent to everybody. That's apartheid. It's actually worse than the apartheid system that we saw in Africa. And that's what the people in West Bank are forced to endure. And that's what the people in Gaza voted against when they voted for Hamas. They voted for change. We want change. I think that's what Obama was presenting, wasn't it? It was change. So they voted for change. We don't want checkpoints everywhere. We want to be able to have freedom of movement in the place that we live. So they voted for Hamas. And so because they voted not to be subject to this apartheid system that everybody in the West Bank is subject to, Israel claimed Hamas is a terrorist organization and they have had the place under siege since, 2007 or 2006. And it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. And it's supported by our governments, and we need to pay attention because, as I said earlier, the way of Palestine will be the way of the world if we don't pay attention simply because of this method of surplusing and warehousing that we're seeing there.
You know, for anybody who's listened to us, I can guarantee you that this conversation that Max and I are having, you will never, never hear in the mainstream media. And I don't have to say why. But, you know, I remember I had a great aunt of mine who was married to a Palestinian. And I remember how he told me the story, because the whole world thinks that when Israel came there, there was nobody there. There were people who lived there and they were asked to leave. And if they didn't, they killed them. And this is one part of the history that is not in the history books here. Is this why the whole Israel lie continues to be perpetuated, Max?
Well, yeah, I mean, they dispossessed 750,000 people immediately when Israel was formed. 750,000 people dispossessed straight away. And these people are still refugees and they have no place to return to. You know, they have no home to return to. They number about 5 million now. These are the families of these refugees that are living all around the place in Yemen and in everywhere all around the area. And we find even living in England, you know. So there's people all around the place that are dispossessed Palestinians. And I mean, if that wasn't bad enough, that was in the 1948 boundaries when England actually set the boundaries, the United Nations actually set the boundaries and decided to annex, part of Palestine and turn it into Israel. And that would have been okay. I mean, that was bad enough, but hey, they would have got away with it. But since then, 2 years later in 1950, Israel started its settlement program. And then it just started taking over the rest of Palestine. And now we've got to the stage where Palestine is virtually gone. It's virtually all Israel now. And they just say, oh, these Palestinians won't stop harassing us. But again, the Palestinians are forced to live in this apartheid legal system whereby they're dispossessed every other day. The government of Israel comes in, they put a moat around their suburb, they bulldoze it, and they just tell the people to go live somewhere else. They don't supply anywhere for them to live. They just tell them to go away. But of course, they can't leave the area because they don't have a nationality, so they can't have a passport, so they can't leave. They just go and live in the desert. Go away. Go live with your relatives. We don't care. You're not a person. You're just a Palestinian. You know, and that's the way these people are treated. So you're only ever going to see animosity from the Arab world towards Israel. And Israel is an illegitimate state. It was founded in 1948 by the United Nations. It actually came about from a thing called the Balfour Declaration, which was written by James Balfour back in 1917 or 1916 and given to Rothschild. And even you can take it further and look at pre-World War II, there was a thing called the Transfer Agreement, which was made by Zionists and Adolf Hitler. When Hitler started shipping Jews out of Germany down to Palestine, Hitler actually inadvertently founded Israel. He financed the founding of Israel, Hitler's government, basically, through the Transfer Agreement. And this is how it was all formed. And there was always an area within Palestine that was known as Israel. And that's where the Jewish people came from. But it wasn't a country. It was just an area within a place. It was like, Colorado Springs in Colorado. It doesn't mean Colorado Springs is a different country. It's just a place within Colorado. You know what I mean? It's like
Chinatown in New York or San Francisco.
Exactly. But what if Chinatown in New York decided it was going to become China? And it was going to put borders around the place, and then all the United Nations were going to give it weapons and it was going to arm itself. And it was just, then it decided that now it's got that, it's going to gradually take over the rest of New York. What would the New York people think about it? That's exactly what's happening in Palestine and in Israel. And Zionism, what is Zionism? Zionism is the belief that an Israeli state should be founded in Palestine. That's basically what Zionism is. And so people who are Zionists are supporting the creation and the perpetuation of Israel, which is essentially an illegitimate state. And if you really look at Orthodox Jews, they'll tell you that Israel is not supposed to be there. Even
right.
In their Bible, it says it's not supposed to be there. The Jews have no country. So the formation of Israel is an abomination against God. That's what Orthodox Jews will tell you. And the Jews get the blame for all of this. I mean, everything that the state of Israel does, which is a Zionist mechanism run by the Rothschilds, essentially, and run by the whole Vatican and Crown Corporation, that's essentially what it is. When this does all of this terrible stuff, it's the Jewish people who get the blame. But most of the Jewish people don't even want Israel to be there. You know, so it's a very, very clever situation that they've contrived. But it's basically just an instability mechanism, and it is an illegitimate state, and it's going to bring about its own implosion. I mean, you don't even have to fight against Israel. That's the thing, because it's being so arrogant now. The state of Israel is being so arrogant and having so little regard for human rights that is bringing about its own demise. It will self-destruct. It will implode. And this will be a direct result of its settlement program, its colonization program.
Well, it's slow genocide. And I recently, Max, interviewed a former congressman, Jim Traffigan. I don't know if you ever heard his name here, but he was set up and was sent to jail for 7.5 years. He was even told by Congress, look, if you admit to your charges, we'll let you go. And he said, no, I'm not going to admit something that I didn't do. And the reason why he was set up was because he found legislation of funding that we were giving billions of dollars that we were giving Israel. And he found, he said, okay, I'm going to agree to this as long as you don't use the money to expand the settlements into the Palestinian areas. Well, you know, they approved it. And not even 2 weeks later or 2 months later, he found out that they used the money for building settlements, and he threw a stink. Well, guess what? The whole wrath of Zionists came down and they sent him to jail.
Well, yeah, that's what they do. I mean, it's all about, that's what Zionism is. Zionism is about dispossessing the Palestinian people, and it's about turning the whole place into Israel. That's what it is. And, all of this funding, there's a thing called the Jewish National Fund as well, which presents itself as a charity in most nations. And this is one of the main sources of funding for the settlement program as well. So anybody who donates to the Jewish National Fund, you're donating to the dispossession of the Palestinian people. But, I mean, it can't go on. It can't go on, and it will bring about the implosion of Israel by its own actions. In many ways, Netanyahu is the best thing that ever happened to Palestine because he's so arrogant. And he is so obviously a fascist and a supporter of you know, genocide and ethnic cleansing and basically terrorism. I mean, that's what they carry out against the Palestinian people all the time is terrorism. And he is so arrogant that the world support is beginning to wane. You know, people are beginning to withdraw their support from Israel because the populations of our countries are getting so irate with our governments for supporting this place. The governments have to, you know, they have to try to maintain some semblance of order and some semblance of working for the people. And so they're not having much choice. They have to start withdrawing their support. And it can only ever bring about the implosion of Israel. I mean, as I said, back in the 1948 borders, I mean, they were bad enough, but they could have got away with it. They could have got away with it if they just left it like that. The two states could have existed together, but they wouldn't allow that to happen. And so now it'll go back to a one-state solution. It's becoming obvious that a one-state solution is the only solution possible. And the state will not be Israel because I don't think the world will allow it. The biggest problem we really face in all of that, of course, is Israel's claim that it will implement the Samson option if it's threatened.
Yeah.
That's right. The real problem, you know.
And this whole hypocrisy of Iran, that Iran is allegedly building a nuclear weapon. You and I move to our neighborhood, and then you have weapons that you do not declare, Max, and I maybe will have one. And then all of a sudden you rally everybody else around me, and even though I declare that I don't have it, you rally the entire world against me, but you have weapons. Do you understand that hypocrisy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And you look at Iran. I mean, Iran hasn't exactly invaded a lot of people in the last 200 years, has it?
That's right.
You know, it's not an aggressive nation. It just wants to be left alone and do what it does, you know. And you've got Israel there threatening everybody around it. I mean, it's invaded. It's showed aggression towards every other country around in the Middle East. And it says, oh, They're all, that's because they all hate us. Well, they all kind of hate you because you're not supposed to be there. And yeah, you're all from Western Europe anyway. Why don't you all go back to Western Europe? You know, and that's, you know, that they've been the aggressor in every single conflict that they've been involved in. And they're the aggressor just by being there. And that's something that people forget with Palestine as well. When the Palestinians fight back, well, hang on, they're not attacking Israel, they're defending themselves against Israel. How can you attack an aggressor? You can't. Israel is an aggressive state. Palestine is occupied territory. It's just that it's been occupied for 60 years now. The war's been going on for 60 years, so people forget that that the occupation even exists. But it does. It's an occupied territory. And everything Israel's done against it is a war crime. And it's just this posturing against Iran. It's pathetic. And, Iran's sort of wondering why, and, you know, and we're seeing it as well in the movies. We're seeing all this Islamophobia and Iran phobia. erupting in the movies now. They're trying to condition everybody to accepting a predetermined outcome, which is what Hollywood's all about.
Of course.
It's interesting. It's very touch and dry, touch and go at the moment, but I don't think they're going to get away with it. I don't think World War III will happen because I just don't think the people of the world are going to allow it. It may happen if they disarm the American people, though.
That's right. I think that's exactly why they're doing it, because they know that if they pull another false flag like they did in, you know, we have 9/11, we have the main, we can talk in history that every single war has started because of a false flag. But you have people like Yitzhak Rabin that was killed by a Zionist. Then you have, Ariel Sharon. Whatever happened to Ariel Sharon? Is he dead or is he still in a coma hidden somewhere?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was actually thinking about Sharon the other day. I'll have to check up on that.
You know, it makes you wonder because we never heard that he died. And I know that it's after he started turning from an eagle into a dove. He really wanted peace. And all of a sudden, whenever a somebody of a high importance in Israel starts embracing peace, it seems that they get rid of him.
Oh, of course. I mean, even look at the last conflict they just had with Gaza. The way it started was, Israel shot, Ahmed Jabir, the Palestinian member of Hamas, head of Hamas military. Yep. He was the guy brokering the peace accord. He had a lasting truce that was going to be implemented between Palestine and Israel, which would have brought about a lasting truce. So that's, of course, who they shot. They targeted them. And then when Hamas responded, oh, look, we're being attacked by Hamas and we have to launch a war. So they always take out whoever's promoting peace. They always do. It's a tried and true method. They do it all the time. Israel doesn't want peace. It wants conflict. It can only survive with conflict. That's its whole purpose.
Because they know that by having conflict, we're going to continue shipping weapons to them. If they have peace, we don't think that there's a reason why we should continue. And I don't understand this, Max. A country that's full of people who are smart, entrepreneurial people, why do we have to send so many billions of dollars every year when we have so many dilapidated roads and bridges and schools here and our teachers can't even make a living with their salaries?
Well, because you have a Christian-based culture, and it says in the Hebrew Bible written by the Hebrew people that the Hebrews are God's chosen people, and so you have to support them and send them everything that you can. And that everything they do, it's all good because it's all God's will, because it says so in the book that they wrote. You know,
they wrote the script. And what is this thing about the fishermen that they can only go a certain distance from the shore to fish, but they cannot get good fish because good fish are in deep waters?
Well, yeah. I mean, you're only allowed 3 nautical miles offshore in Gaza. They actually raised that to 6 nautical miles since the war. So the last, what they called the war, the 8-day war, the latest bout of ethnic cleansing. They doubled the limit to 6 miles, but of course, then they started shooting fishermen out there again anyway. There's been half a dozen fishermen shot since the ceasefire. There's been a few people shot on the border since the ceasefire, and Israel's already lobbed a few more bombs in there since the ceasefire. So, yeah, 3 nautical miles. And I mean, your fishing grounds are 10 to 20 miles offshore, always. You know, that's where you catch your good fish. And Palestinians' territorial waters—that's their waters. They should be allowed to fish in them, but you'll find that there's Israeli gunboats 3 miles off the shore. You can see them in Gaza. You can see them out on the horizon. They're just there. You can't quite photograph them because the camera doesn't pick them up. They're too far out, but you can see them there, just on the edge of the horizon, and they will shoot any boats that go out past the 3 mile zone. You can also see an Israeli gas platform out there, like a big rig out there extracting gas from Palestinian waters as well. So yeah, they're under complete blockade. They're not allowed to send boats out there. They're not allowed to bring anything in. And yeah, it's shocking, absolutely shocking. And fishing was one of the biggest industries and the main sources of food they had in Gaza. Now it's just the vegetables that they can grow themselves and a lot of chicken. There's lots of chickens there. That's about the only meat that they can really get. So, it's a very, very sad situation.
How many children there are parentless, at least without a father?
Oh, lots. lots and lots, hard to estimate. I mean, the story of the Samouni family was a particularly touching story that I got told while I was there. And, it's the same for almost every family. There's so many homeless children. There really is. Even in the Samouni family, there's so many, one little boy lost five brothers and sisters and both parents in one day, during Operation Cast Lead. So many children. I mean, and during Cast Lead, I mean, one of the first things that they would do is they'd walk into a home, they'd ask who's the head of the household. The man would stand up and so they'd shoot him straight away in front of the family. This happened to a lot of families. They would just shoot the men. There's 4,600 men currently, at least currently detained in Israeli jails without charge or trial. Just been picked up at checkpoints and picked up at the border and carried off and basically dropped into a black hole, held in one of 27 different prisons or centers of detention throughout Israel. And without charge or trial, some of them have been there up to, one guy's been there 29 years, I think, without charge or trial. And they keep them in solitary for 2 or 3 years at a time sometimes. They're not allowed any visitors from their family. And if they pick someone up in the West Bank, if they ever do release them, they'll usually release them into Gaza. And if they pick someone up in Gaza, they'll release them into the West Bank. And you can't get from the West Bank to Gaza.
I was going to say, how do you get to one point to the other?
You don't. You can't. And so that means you're dropped into exile and your family is 20 miles away from you and you can't ever get to see them because you can't get across Israel. So it's just blatant cruelty and it's very purposely done. And, it's absolutely shocking. You know, the amount of relish that the guards, exude when they're doing these things, they love it. They absolutely love tormenting these people because they're just Palestinians. They're less than dogs, you know, and that's unfortunately what we're seeing. So yeah, there's a lot of parentless children in Gaza. And as I said, over half the population of people in Gaza is kids. It was kids who smuggled us in. The kids who got us in were like 17, 18-year-old kids who got us in through these tunnels. They dug themselves, these rebel tunnels. The kids are fantastic.
You know, you think of the Jews in Germany and Hungary and Poland, and you think of what they supposedly went through. And you would think that history they would carry and the never again attitude. But then again, they're doing exactly the same thing with the Palestinians. We think of the Holocaust, but we don't think of this Holocaust as happening right under our noses. And we taxpayers in the United States are financing it in a way.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is the Jewish kids, I mean, the young kids now, they don't use the Holocaust as a means of, lest we forget. Let us never forget what was done to us. What they use is they brainwash the kids into thinking you're an eternal victim. This is what the world did to the Jews. And so you have to fight. You have to realize that you are God's chosen people and that all of these goyim, they only did this because you're God's chosen people. They're jealous of you and you have to protect your birthright and the whole world is out to get you. So you have to defend yourself against the whole world. That's kind of the mentality that's brainwashed into these kids. It's not a look what was done to us. We must make sure this never is done to anybody else. It's because this is done to us, we have to stand against the rest of the world forever and don't ever take a backward step to anybody because nobody's as good as you are because you're a Jew. You know, and that's the mentality that they're forced into. I mean, a lot of the stuff that you saw in Cast Lead, some of the atrocities, the white phosphorus that they use and the way that the children are tormented. Yeah, you've got to understand the soldiers are whipped up into a frenzy by the rabbis before they go into battle. And the rabbis tell them that to show mercy to a Palestinian is to sin against God, is to sin against who you are. Because you are the eternal victim and you must always, you know, you're fighting for God. God is on your side. Everybody else is just a goyim. You know, they say, you'll get Netanyahu says, Israel stands for human rights more than anybody else. But what you don't understand is that in the Jewish system, the only people who are human are the Jews. The rest are goyim. So they may be standing up for human rights, but what they're really standing up for is Jewish rights. You know, it's a supremacist system. Now, a lot of the normal Jewish people don't feel this way, but this is the way the extremists feel, and this is the culture that they promote, and this is what you get as a result. You know?
And by the way, we're talking here. We're not being anti-Jews, folks. We're just being anti-Zionist. And I'm so tired when people call, you know, somebody who's speaking like this anti-Semite, when a Semite could be an Arab as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, a Semitic is a Middle Eastern person. I mean, Arabs are Semites. Yeah, absolutely. Palestinians are Semites. I mean, they're all Semites. So it's not anti-Semitic at all. And like I said, the Jews are as much the victims in this as anybody. They really are, because it's the actual Jewish people, the actual Semitic Jewish people that are being used as scapegoats in this whole Zionist system. And the whole Zionist system was created by Europeans. So, you know.
The Khazarians.
Yeah, Khazarians and the Rothschilds and all these crews, that's who thought it all up. So it's nothing to do with the Jewish people. They're as much the victim as anybody in this case.
You know, in the United States, as you know, they're talking about having thousands of drones, you know, flying over our heads here. But in the United States, we don't want that. And most people say we don't want that stuff flying over our heads. But, you know, we have these atrocities that happen here with the shootings, which to me are false flags. But we don't think of the drones that have killed, for example, take Pakistan as one country. 172 children died there because somebody in a bunker somewhere playing with the joystick goes there, bombs, not only bombs, but goes what I saw somebody who's tweeting the drone bombing since 2002. And he found something very interesting, Max. He found that one thing they're doing, they bomb and they don't even wait a minute, you know, 10 minutes. They bomb again because that's the strategy that terrorists use. They bomb and they bomb again the moment the first responders come in. So you have all the stuff, children being killed in Pakistan, but in the United States, I hate to say it, people don't care because it's not affecting us. How hypocritical is that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They'll all carry on when there's something like what we just saw in Connecticut. But, yeah, I mean, this is what they do everywhere. I mean, Israel drops bombs on Palestine all the time and killing all children all the time. And like you say, what we did in Pakistan, I mean, and Iraq. I mean, how many people did get killed in Iraq? Look what happened in Fallujah. You know, what they did in Fallujah, I mean, that is one of the worst war crimes in history, what happened in the Iraqi invasion in Operation Shock and Awe, what they did to Fallujah and the children that they've killed all around the planet. We don't shed a tear for that. But when we have someone go into one of our schools and kill our children, we feel like we're the victims. It's incredibly hypocritical. Even with the whole Rachel Corrie thing, as terrible as what happened to Rachel Corrie in Palestine, it's shocking that that's what happened to her. And it shows the disregard they have for Westers, and it shows the disregard the West has for its own citizens. But the really shocking part about it is that it takes for a Westerner to be killed before we notice. This happens to Palestinians all the time.
Mention what happened to Rachel Corrie for anybody who doesn't know what happened to Rachel.
Well, she was standing against the Israelis illegally bulldozing Palestinian homes, and she stood in front of a bulldozer to stop it. And the bulldozer basically knocked her down with the blade, and then it lowered the blade and backed up. It was like it was flattening out the road. It lowered the blade and backed over her with the blade, just basically pushed her into the road with the blade. The last thing she said was, I think my back is broken. And then she died. And the driver was exonerated, actually, while we were in Palestine, while we were in Gaza. The case went to trial, and the driver was found that he was free of any guilt. Rachel Corrie had been interfering, and she'd been in the wrong place at the wrong time. And there was nothing said by America about this. And she was a young, like 24-year-old American girl. And the American government just accepted Israel's decision. So it shows how little regard Western governments have for their own citizens if the citizens are killed by Israel. And it shows how little regard Israel has for human life. But like I said, the really shocking part about it is that this happens to Palestinian people all the time, and no one notices. There's no court cases or no trials for any drivers that are involved in bulldozing Palestinian people. They don't count. Yeah, and it happens all the time, every day. The amount of children is over 300 children that are held in Israeli jails as well. Now, kids under the age of 18 have just been picked up at checkpoints and taken to jail and held there never to be seen again. And this happens all the time. And it's absolutely shocking what happened to Rachel Corrie, but like I said, it happens on a daily basis to Palestinian people. Why don't we notice that? Why don't we notice when other people's children are killed? And especially when it's done by our governments. And our governments finance what's going on in Israel. Our governments finance what's going on in Afghanistan, what's going on in Iraq, what's going on in Syria. All of these things are created by Western governments. And a lot of children are dying all around the world as a result of the actions of our governments. You're getting away with it because we don't understand who we are. We don't understand that our governments are simply public trustees. The only people who can rein them in are us. And we have to do it. We absolutely have to do it. We can't do it from within their legal parameters. We have to do it by discovering our inner power and standing in what we have ourselves and standing up as one united family and saying, look, enough is enough. We're not going to do this anymore. It's really simple for us to do. I mean, they did it in Iceland, and it would be a simple thing for us to do if we could simply put down the division we have with each other. To me, that's the answer to the whole thing.
This whole domino that started in Tunisia last year, and then Egypt, then Libya, now Syria. I had a conversation with Robert Bouval, one of our guests here and a researcher, and he was very happy to see the Arab Spring taking place. But I told him back then, even back then, I said, you know, yes, Mubarak was a dictator, and I'm glad that he's gone, but it's the devil we know. Now, why do you think this is all happening? Do you think this is orchestrated, and what is the plan of this whole Arab Spring? And obviously Syria seems to be next.
Well, it's about instability. I mean, I don't think they expected Morsi to get in Egypt. I don't think that was the plan. Morsi's reasonably sympathetic to Palestine as well. I think it's caused a little bit of a spanner in the works. But, I mean, it's all about instability. It's about destabilizing the region. Yeah, you know, as soon as you get it destabilized, then, you know, the good guys will have to come in on the white, you know, nights, and we'll have to come in and fix it all. That's why we do it. We destabilize regions so that then we can go in and fix it. That's what it's all about. And we don't fix it. We just go and put in a puppet regime that is going to be supportive of the West. So the West can basically consolidate its corporate control over the rest of the world. That's how they do it. Order out of chaos. Auto ab chao. It says it on every Freemason logo everywhere. And that's what they use. That's a mechanism that they use. They have to destabilize the whole region, the whole Arab region, in order to control it. And, I mean, if they go to war with Iran, if they do manage to get this started, well, if they've destabilized all down through Tunisia or through Egypt or through Syria, Libya, well, who's Iran going to get support from? Because the whole rest of the Arab world is in a complete state of disarray. So who is Iran going to have any help from? It's not, because all of its allies are in a state of civil war that we've created.
So Russia and China.
Well, there's Russia and China, of course, but none of the Arabs, you know, none of the Arab nations are going to help. Yeah, this is what they do. And if they can do it in the right way and maneuver themselves into a position where they're surrounding China, I mean, that's the big standoff. Russia isn't really much of a threat anymore, but China most certainly is. China's a sleeping giant.
Yeah.
And they're really trying to maneuver themselves into a position where they can control China. I mean, they're doing it economically anyway. Given enough time, they won't even need to go to war with China. They'll just do it economically. I mean, they kind of respect China. They kind of like China as well, because they like the Chinese system. They like the regimented mentality of the Chinese. They like the regimented workforce of China. Greatly admired by people such as the Rothschilds, people such as the Rockefellers. They would like to see all American workplaces and Australian and British workplaces to be as regimented as they are in China.
Well, it's their creation.
Well, yeah. So they're quite happy with China being there. They can use China as the big threat. But I think ultimately they like the Chinese system. I think China likes Western culture. It likes capitalism. I mean, it's like it's on capitalism on steroids at the moment in China. It loves the all the glitz and glamour and all the stuff that capitalism provides. And so it's kind of embracing that. And I think that they'll just use China as the big threat, the big boogeyman to be scared of. But I don't think we're going to ever see a war with China. I think we're going to see a merging of Western culture and Chinese culture. That's what they would like to create. They actually like to push the Chinese model out to the rest of the world, but they'll use it as a threat in the meantime. But the real threat is from the Arab world, because whether people believe it or not, there's more freedom in the Arab world than there is in the Western world. You know, it's the last ancient language as well. We've got to get rid of the ancient languages, get rid of Arabic, because Arabic is one of the original languages. Aramaic, you know, it's like we've lost Sanskrit, we've lost ancient Hebrew, we've got now modern Hebrew. The last ancient language we have is Aramaic. And these are the languages that connect you to the earth as well, that connect you back to nature. And people think that the Arab world is a very, very controlled society, but it's really not. It's quite a free society in many ways. And they don't want that. They really want everything to be corporate. It's got to be capitalism and it's got to be corporatism, because that's what freedom is according to our parameters. And that's what they're trying to push.
But what do you tell? I bet you I can hear our female listeners listening to us now saying, wait a second, how about women that live in the area that, for example, in Saudi Arabia, they were allowed to vote, but since they cannot drive, they can't get to the voting booth. What do you say about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's certain sections of the Arab world that are quite dictatorish, Saudi Arabia being the worst. And again, that's the one that we support the most. I mean, Saudi Arabia is one of the most extremist governments on the planet. And yeah, that's the one we support the most. I mean, the people that I met in Palestine, the women, the burqas and the they like wearing these things, you know. I mean, and Western women will think, well, you know, hang on, the Arab women have to cover themselves up. But hang on, Western women cover themselves up with makeup. And they pretend that they're something that they're not. And all the Arab women do is they cover themselves up because they don't like the guys looking at their stuff. Why do you need to look at my stuff? Why can't you just see me through my eyes? My eyes are the windows to the soul. If you can't know me from my eyes, then what are your interests in me? So, you know, I mean, it's a delicate situation. It's hard to talk about with people, of course. And there are certainly, countries that are more controlled than others. And like you said, Saudi Arabia, I mean, that is what is presented to us as being one of the more progressive Arab nations because we support it so much. But really, it's one of the most controlled Arab nations. So I think that there is a certain amount of freedom, and the freedom that there isn't, well, I think they're sort of protecting themselves against the West. I saw a really interesting film actually recently called Propaganda. It was a North Korean film, and it's about the West. It's a North Korean propaganda film, and it's basically, it shows the West exactly for what it is. It was quite remarkable, really. I mean, of course, it's propaganda promoting, saying, hey, we're the good guys. But really, yeah. When you look at it, it's a pretty convincing story because it shows the absolute degradation and debauchery and decadence, which is Western culture. And it absolutely is. And if that's what we call freedom, well, I think we've got things a little mixed up. And I can understand why cultures become strict in order to protect themselves against Western freedom. I really do, because what we call freedom is not really freedom. I mean, we seem to promote this incredibly promiscuous lifestyle, and we call that freedom, and we distract ourselves with that. We distract ourselves with fashions and sex and glamour and all this stuff, while the real freedoms are being eroded away from us because we're distracted by all these bright lights and pretty bodies and things, you know?
Well, that's what happened with Iraq. You know, we think, gosh, you know, Saddam Hussein, I bet you he was not a nice guy, but he kept the country together. The Sunnis, the Shias and the Kurds, he glued them together, and people were able to go to universities there. And then you have Libya. And again, we had, we demonized Muammar Gaddafi here as a dictator, but he made that country shine. That country was helping the entire continent of Africa. He wanted to sponsor and to finance 50% of a telecommunications satellite for the entire continent of Africa. He wanted to peg the currency to gold. He wanted an African currency. He wanted to make the entire country of Libya, he wanted to put water tubes under the sand there to make it a garden. And we got rid of him. Why? Because all of a sudden he started talking about not buying gold in dollars. It seems to be the case with all those people there. And by the way, I don't think our democracy works in that area of the world. I hate to say it, but you know, when they have dictators there, it seems that things work that way because that's how they have been accustomed for hundreds of years.
Well, it's an interesting culture as well. I mean, Arabic culture is a very, very different culture to Western culture. It really is. And if you've got a good person with good ideas who wants to do things to help the country, people are quite happy to have someone there doing that. Hey, if he's doing the right thing and everything's, we're all prospering from it, why change it? Why fix it if it isn't broken?
Right.
That's kind of the attitude that they have. And if they find someone who's got a good heart and who is a good leader, they're quite happy for them to be there. And you'll find that a lot of the time you'll have other parties come in that are all sympathetic to the West and all sorts of stuff. And really, if they get voted in, then it's going to undermine your culture. And so the ruling factions see these parties as a threat to their culture. And so, you know, you have these dictatorships. And that's kind of the way it works. But I mean, a dictatorship is only as bad as the dictator. Yeah, you know, you could have good dictators and that are quite beneficial. And Gaddafi seems to have done a lot of good stuff for Libya. He really does. I mean, if you really look at some of the benefits that the Libyans had, then you've really got to wonder what the problem was with this guy from a Libyan perspective. And the only real problem with him was that he didn't bow to the West. As you said, he wanted to, he wanted to start their own, the African currency, a national currency for Africa. And wanted to trade in that, which would have completely destroyed the whole European model. And that's why it was such a threat. I mean, like you say, as soon as it comes to currency, then you become a threat. And when the rebels, you know, the so-called rebels in Libya, when they had their first little victory, what was the first thing they did? They
central bank
established a central bank. Yeah. I mean, and central banking is exactly what is wrong with the Western world. So if people cannot see that was a staged event. The first thing the rebels did was establish a central bank. I mean, if they can't see that, then I don't know what it will take to wake these people up. But it was so obviously a staged event.
In the last part of the show, Max, we're discussing issues that plague the entire world. But I want to give hope for the new year. And you said something in a presentation, and I thought this is great to hear somebody else going through the same thing. You explain exactly what happened to me with the creation of this radio program. I put myself in an emotional state where I imagine myself as a radio host, making enough to support the operation and my family and I, and then disseminate the information around the world. I imagined the end result. And guess what happened, Max? The thoughts materialized. Is that the same thing that happened to you?
Well, yeah, that's really what happens. I mean, I used to hit chat rooms and I was doing everything I could for quite a number of years trying to get this message out. I thought, how do I harness the power of the internet? You know, all I could think of was chat rooms and things, you know, and then I discovered YouTube. And so I started making clips and videos and putting them up there. And I had this incredible download in 2008. I had this amazing meditation experience where I really connected with the field around me. It was like I connected with a quantum universe on a quantum field and connected with everything. It was a split second of a connection. It felt like forever, but it was probably just a second or two. And I fell out of my chair. I fell down onto my knees on the floor, and I cried for 7 hours after this experience. It was a profound experience. And I realized through all that the power of my emotions, and I made a film called The Awakening. I tried to explain to people how your heart is an electromagnetic generator and how when you have a strong emotion, you create an electromagnetic field with your heart that communicates to the world around you. And you're literally talking to creation all the time through the electromagnetic field that's generated by your heart. And so what I did was I decided, well, wouldn't it be good if I was a radio host? That's what I need to do. I need to be something like a radio host where I'm talking and I'm getting this information out to enough people. I'm getting it out to the world and I'm making enough just to be able to get by so that I can still continue to do the radio shows. And so I'd get up every morning and I would put myself in the emotional state where that's what I was. I was a radio host. I was sitting here in my office and I was getting the world, you know, the world was listening. I was getting the message out to the world. They were listening and everything was good. And I put myself in that emotional state. It isn't that I hoped for it. I actually believed that's what I was, you know, like you believe it, you know it.
Yeah.
You put yourself in that emotional state. I'm not saying that I was delusional. I was believing I was a radio host, nothing like that. But you put yourself in the energetic state where what you are looking for has already come to you. You're basically in a state of thanks for this feeling being fulfilled. It's like if you want a relationship with someone, you want to meet the perfect woman or the perfect man, then you put yourself in the state where you are with your perfect partner. and then that will manifest. You'll draw that into your life. Well, that's what I did in this. And the reason I did it that way was, if you look at American Indians, you look at the way the American Indians will pray, the way they'll do a rain dance, for example, is they will put themselves in the emotional state where they're standing in the rain. They don't pray for rain, because if you pray for rain, you're acknowledging that there is no rain. So it's kind of a negative affirmation. The way you pray for rain is you put yourself in the emotional state where you are standing in the pouring rain. So that's what I did. I put myself in the emotional state where I was a radio host. And then within about 4 to 6 weeks, I was offered a job as a radio host, and I've been a radio host ever since. And it just manifested out of the blue. I'd never thought about being a radio host or planned on being a radio host, but I just had this feeling one day that that was the method I could use to get the message out to the people. And so what if I just put myself in the emotional state where the prayer was already answered? And bang, it manifested. And I've done this with other things in my life as well. I've realized now that if you put yourself in the emotional state where what you are looking for is already part of your life, then it will manifest and it will become part of your life. That's how it works.
Absolutely. I have a smile because I think, wow, it's great to know that there's more people who have gone through the same thing. And it's also the power of attraction, the law of attraction. If you do something that you love, not work, but something that you love, you will attract people. You probably attracted a producer out there that said, this man is what we need for this job. And it landed on you. And it happens to me all the time. I think of the end result. And what happens to most people, they think of all the steps from point A to point Z. And it's difficult sometimes. It's overwhelming to seeing all the steps. But if you imagine yourself in point Z, sitting exactly in the position you want to be in and believing that that's where you are, it just happens. As Max is saying, the universe works, the spirit world. Sometimes all you need to do is ask. We just don't ask because we don't believe that this could be happening. But, you know, once we have these experiences, one happens, you know, after the other. And you realize that the reason why you are placed here, you had a reason, you had a goal to fulfill, there is a purpose, and that's exactly what happens.
Well, it does. It absolutely does. And it's more of a law of mirroring than even a law of attraction. Law of attraction, I think, they were very sneaky with that, with The Secret and all of that. They thought, oh, gee, people are finding out about this law of mirroring. They're finding out how emotions create reality. So we need to get them focused on finances and wealth and personal gain and manifesting your fortune and all this sort of stuff. Prosperity. I tell people I don't want prosperity. I want abundance. Prosperity is something that you buy. I want my natural state of abundance, because that is the natural state of all human beings. It's a natural state of this planet, is abundance. And really it's a law of mirroring, because if you put yourself in the correct emotional state, reality will mirror that state back to you. You're not attracting something into your life. If you're attracting it through the law of attraction, very often you're attracting it with your head. You're focusing on something with your mind, and so you're creating in duality. If you create from your heart, but because you're putting yourself in an emotional state that is pure, it's a pure emotional state, it's an energy. You're not thinking, I want to be a radio host. You're thinking, I am a radio host. This is what it feels like to be changing the world, you know? And suddenly you're changing the world. So it mirrors that back to you. You know what I'm saying? Law of attraction is very, very sneaky, the way they've kind of hijacked this law of mirroring, and they've hijacked this emotional language, and they've turned it into a head trip again. You know, they just do this. They mind control, mate. That's how they do it.
I have a question here for you, Max, from Anastasia in Ontario, Canada. She says, hi, Max. Mel couldn't have a better guest than you to wrap up this 2012 year, assuming we're all still here, of course. I've heard you speak of your horrific childhood, and I wonder, why do you think some people are able to overcome their traumas and grow to find their inner light, while others who endure similar violence waste their lives consumed by hate? P.S. I know you miss your anonymity, but I love your face. In Lakesh, Anastasia.
Oh, that's very lovely for her to have said that. Look, I think some people find ways of moving through it so we can share it with others. You know, people come here for specific reasons. I believe I have specific purposes for being here. And I think that everything that's happened to me in my life has been, it's been a gift. It's happened to me so that I could understand what other people have been through. And so I could help open the doorway for them. I can share my experiences with them and show them that you can move through things. You really can. It's all about what you do with the time that's given to you. So I treasure every moment that's ever happened to me. I forgive any transgression that's ever been carried out against me. And I'm happy for it all because it all made me who I am today. And that gives me the ability to be able to share the information that I do. So I think it all serves a purpose. I think we can all move through this stuff. It's just that some people lack the tools. They lack the spiritual understandings of how to do it. And hopefully I can help provide a little bit of that for them. And that's probably why I've been able to move through these things so I can share it with others.
And, you know, I have another question here, but I just thought of something. When I spend time in Southeast Asia in the mid-90s, I learn how selfish we are in the Western world when we always say, treat people the way you want to be treated. And when I was there, I learned that you treat people the way they want to be treated. That's how you build an empathic mind. But here's a question from Ted in Colorado, I believe. My question, thank you for coming to hello, Max. Thank you for coming on Veritas to close out the year with us. We appreciate it. My question, I recently heard you briefly discuss your visit to Peru and your participation in a ceremony in which reconnected you to our earth along with an understanding that this is the way our connection to it was supposed to be. Could you expand on your experience there with us regarding this ceremony and what you experienced, and also speak of the importance of this connection we naturally have with this planet and why we have been steered away from it? Thank you so much and best wishes, Ted.
Well, it's like I was saying earlier about how your highest senses are a way that you can interact with reality. That's what I experienced in the ceremony. Was I basically had the Amazon jungle tell me its emotional story. And I can't even convey to you what that was because it wasn't conveyed to me in anything that we would construe as language. But what I saw was a really, really deep connection, the way we could live in absolute harmony with this planet if we were left to our own devices and we operated in harmony with this planet, we would be looked after. We absolutely would. The experience was an ayahuasca experience. I was lying out in a little cabin by myself. I was just listening to the sounds of the jungle. I had the shaman singing off in the distance, and it just showed me all this. But it also showed me that you don't need ayahuasca to do it. That was really just the mechanism that I used to discover this information. And I'd always known that I had this connection. I'd always known that I had this connection to reality and I had this connection to the universe. I've always known that I've been able to control my reality through controlling my emotional state. But what I got from it, from this ceremony, was a real immersing into that world. And I got to basically visit the spirit realm. I got to see what exists outside visible light. I got to have a lot of spirits and entities and things from the past, and even the Earth Mother herself, come and communicate with me and tell me their story. And I saw how deep our connection is supposed to be and how far we are from it, how far we've been disconnected from it. And the mechanisms that have been used to do it are, like I said, the enslavement to the written word. And since then, it's been a biological adjustment, you know, the adjustment of our biology, the toxins that have been put into our environment. The big thing is the closing off of the pineal gland, which is done through fluoride, but it's also done through fear. If you're in this fear vibration, your body just shuts down. And we live in a state of fear-based mind control, and the very root of the system is money. Money is designed to keep people in a state of shortage and keep people in a state of contrived scarcity by forcing you to pay for everything that you need to be alive. You know, if you don't have money, you can't live. It's ridiculous. I mean, you're born onto this planet. Why do you have to pay to be here? Everything that you need to survive is provided for you in abundance all over the planet, but we're disconnected from that through the imposition of an economic system over human psyche. I've got all of this. I mean, I've known this all the time, but I could see it so clearly in ceremony. And I saw that all we have to do is, it's like I've been saying for years. I mean, I got a massive confirmation of everything that I've been saying on the radio shows. I saw that all we have to do, really, is to respect each other and love each other. And we're not going to do that until we find ourselves and love ourselves. And that's when I started telling people, well, you're perfect. Why would you consider yourself to be anything but perfect? Because when you understand how reality works and that your body is simply a biological computer downloading a frequency that you experience as Mel Fabregas, I download a frequency from the same field that I experience as Max Egan, but ultimately it comes from the same source, then why would you consider yourself to be anything but perfect? Because no one could be Mel Fabregas any better than you can. You're absolutely perfect at being Mel Fabregas, better than anybody ever could. So why would you ever consider yourself to be anything but perfect? Why would you ever consider anybody to be a threat against you experiencing you? Because they're not, and you experiencing you is what you're here to experience, obviously, because that's who you are. So once you see this and you see this perfection in yourself, then you begin to see this in everybody. You begin to see just how valid every single person in this reality is, and all the walls break down, all the barriers break down, and you begin to see that even the people who control our government, they're just people the same as us. They're perfect at being themselves too. What they're being may be a little distracted from reality, but you know, that's just because they've been trained to think that way. But hey, it's all a fictional system anyway. We can rein the whole lot in by realizing what it is. It's just fiction. These guys are just trustees. I mean, I got the whole lot from the ceremony, and it was a massive confirmation of everything that I've been saying on the radio show. But I got to see and I got to feel what it actually would be like if we were reconnected to source and if we were reconnected to the earth. And the earth is the most important thing. It should be the most important thing to everybody, because this is our home. This is who we are. We are so connected to this planet. You know, we can't live without this planet. The planet can live without us, but we can't live without it. And we're being very neglectful and very disrespectful of the planet, because we're being very disrespectful to ourselves. We have to start respecting ourselves, and we have to start respecting each other. Once we do that, the whole system changes by default. And that's basically what I got from the ceremony. So it was a pretty remarkable experience for me.
I'm always saying that we treat this planet as if we had another one to go to. But the other day I found that two young scientists were able to photograph an atom, and they put a picture of the atom next to a picture of a galaxy. And they put the picture of the atom on top of the galaxy, and they looked exactly the same. And the first thought that came to mind was, wow, so an atom could be its own world. And I'm not saying this in a religious way, but that tells me that atom, human beings, we are all part of God. We are all together what is considered God.
Well, yeah, I mean, an atom is the same as a galaxy. It's the same as a solar system. At the center of every atom is a black hole. You know, yeah. There's that contraction. And if you look at light in this universe, you look at this universe, you shine light out into this universe, eventually it'll come back and hit you in the back of the head eventually after a few hundred billion years, you know, because light will never leave this universe. It can't leave this universe, because this universe probably exists also within the center of a black hole. So therefore it exists conceivably within the center of an atom, because all that actually exists is consciousness. Consciousness running through creation and through reality at light speed. That's basically what exists. I mean, all matter is created through conscious observation anyway. You look at the measurement problem. You know, a scientist can't even measure an atom until he goes to measure it. He can't measure it because the electrons that revolve around the nucleus are infinite. It isn't until he actually goes to measure it that the electrons coalesce to create the atom. Before that, the electrons exist everywhere at once. How can that be? How can they exist everywhere at once? You know, and it's the act of observation that creates the atom. So therefore, the act of observing the universe is what creates the universe. It's our belief and our perception that the universe is here, which even creates it. So therefore, anything's possible. It's what you believe is possible that controls what's possible. And what you believe is usually controlled by the written word. Because we're enslaved to the written word, we're taught that reality has to fit within these parameters. So we don't know things anymore. We only know what we're taught to know. So therefore, this is the reality that we get. This is the universe that we get. It's all very simple when you look at it, but anything is possible. And what really exists throughout all creation is consciousness, because the energy itself that all matter is created from is conscious energy. It's pure conscious energy. Everything is consciousness. Consciousness, that is the mind of God. If there is a God, that's what it is. It is consciousness. It is the conscious fabric of the universe itself. And we are all connected to that conscious fabric. we're just having this grand amnesiac experience, and we're observing reality from billions and billions of different perspectives. But ultimately, there's only one of us here. There's only really the mind of God, whatever you perceive God to be. And that's what we are all connected to. And I think that's what this time in history is. It's human consciousness beginning to reconnect itself to universal consciousness. We're beginning to wake up. We're remembering now who and what we are, and we're seeing how easily we could change things simply by shifting our point of view, shifting our perspective, shifting our concept of what we believe is possible, shifting our concept of what we are and what the people around us are. But, you know, ultimately the change that we're looking for, it can come, but it has to come from within our hearts, and it has to start with the individual. And that's what we're seeing at this time in history. Hell of a time to be alive. Wonderful, wonderful time to be alive. And I think it's only going to go up from this point on, Mel. I really do. I think that this is how it happened, and we're participating in it right now. I think it's an absolutely historical moment.
I never like to say that I want time to speed up or for a day to be over, because to me, the present today is the gift. Not tomorrow. We can't do anything about the past, and there's nothing I can do about tomorrow but today. However, this year, there's so much fear, there's so many doom out there of people saying the world's going to end, when we know, by recording this a few days before December 21st, that we'll still be here. So for 2013 and beyond, give us a powerful message, a la Max Egan.
Well, look, like I just said, I think this is how it happened. This is how we do it. And I think that now in history, more than ever, the mechanism has been laid bare. The workings of the system has been laid bare like never before in history. And this has given us the opportunity and the tools we need for effective change. It really has, but it's got to come from within. It's got to come from people discovering their personal power. I think that's exactly what we're seeing. And everybody out there, you know, all the people that write to me and say they'd like to help, the best thing you can do to help is to lead by example in all that you do. Change your energetic state. Change the way you perceive the world. Change the way you interact with the people around you. Interact with people in Lakesh as yourself. Give the people the respect that you would want for yourself, and the empathy that you have for yourself. And this is how we change the world. We don't really have to do anything. If we start applying ourselves to reality and applying our heart energy to the world around us, the world will change by default. And this is how it happens. This is the time that it can happen. And it has to start now, and it has to start with the individual. It has to start with you. So change your heart space, folks, and apply it to the world around you. Lead by example in all that you do, and you can change the world.
I tell people when I have debates about waking people up or not, you know, all you have to do is what Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. Well, Max Egan, once again, have no idea. It's always an honor, a pleasure to speak with you. I'm glad that nothing happened to you in Gaza and all your travels. So I'm looking forward to having you back in the future. Thank you so much for your very important message.
My pleasure, Mel. Be a pleasure to come on again. I'm going to go back to Gaza in 2013. I have a huge project, the Full Circle Project, I want to start next year, which will encompass a lot of countries, and hopefully it's sort of kind of a global link up, and I do intend on being back in Gaza around about July or August next year. And I actually want to go back and stay for maybe 6 months if I possibly can. So yeah, I'll keep you posted on that one.
Wow. We'll do a show from Gaza, and whatever I can do to help you with that project, please let me know. Happy New Year. Much health and prosperity for you next year.
Same to you, Mel. Thanks for having me on, brother.
Great. Well, thank you so much, and have a good day over there. The 21st is tomorrow for you, huh?
Yeah, it sure is. That'll be interesting. I wonder if the Mayans respect the international dateline. The world might end here before it ends there, right?
That's right. That's right. All right. Well, you take care.
All right, brother. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that was Max Egan from thecrowhouse.com. You gotta love Max and his insights, recounting and closing a year in Lakesh. This brother of truth always has a special place right here on Veritas, and we wish him much health and protection in the coming year as he embarks in new journeys to reveal more truth. And I want to thank you for another Veritas year. Starting next week, we begin season 5. Can you believe it? And all of this wouldn't be possible without you. I want to wish you and your loved ones another year filled with health and happiness. What else could we ask for? May 2013 be the best year yet. And to end, you've heard me say this before. Holding a grudge is letting someone live rent-free in your head. But let's take it a step further as we end this year. Forgive others, not because they deserve forgiveness, but because you deserve peace. Thanks for listening. I'm Mel Famagos. Until next week, or next year, be well, and remember to always think for yourself.